Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, more of Amy Goodman's talk in Cambridge, Mass. It's about the need for independent media. It's also about the power of ordinary people. Plus, we'll have a little music by David Rovix. I hope you'll stay tuned. Independent journalist Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Spoke nearby a few weeks ago. Last week and this week, we present the best parts of her talk. This week, she begins with non-commercial alternative radio station KPFT in Houston. That was dynamited by the Ku Klux Klan shortly after it went on air in May 1970. And dynamited by the Klan again a few months later. Some people just don't like alternative media. Amy connects this with Donald Trump, with the Charleston shootings, and, well, I'll let Amy do the connecting. One correction in advance. The title of Klan High Mucky Muck David Duke was neither Grand Dragon nor Exalted Cyclops. Rather, he was Grand Wizard. Now that I've done my part for media truth and accuracy, here is Amy Goodman.
You know that originally I come from Pacifica Radio. I want to go back to KPFT that went on the air in the spring of 1970 in the Petro Metro in Houston. It's the only radio station in the country whose transmitter was blown up. In the first weeks of operation, blown to smithereens, the Ku Klux Klan strapped dynamite to the base of the transmitter and blew it up. Now, it was right in the middle of Arlo Guthrie singing Alice's Restaurant. And I thought that was a good song. So it took a few weeks. I mean, I guess you could say the silver lining. It's not like Pacifica had money for advertising. It certainly blew it into the consciousness of the potential listening audience of the people of Houston. I don't recommend that as an advertising strategy, but they got back on their feet, and they went back on the air. And then the Klan blew it up again. They strapped 15 times the dynamite to the base of the transmitter and blew it up again. This time it would take much longer. It would take months for them to get back on their feet. And then in January of 1971, PBS came in to broadcast this historic moment, and the phoenix rose from the ashes. That's right, KPFT went back on the air, and Arlo Guthrie came in to finish singing Alice's Restaurant. Now, I can't remember if it was the Grand Dragon or the Exalted Cyclops, because I often confuse their titles. But he said it was his proudest act. And I think that's because he understood how dangerous Pacifica is, how dangerous independent media is. Dangerous because it allows people to speak for themselves. And when you hear someone speaking from their own experience, whether it's a Palestinian child or an Israeli grandmother, whether it's an uncle in Afghanistan, an aunt in Iraq, maybe it's a kid from the South Valley in Albuquerque, where we were just speaking at RFK High School. The overwhelming majority of the population of that high school is undocumented immigrant students. Whether it's a kid from the South Bronx, you're hearing someone speak from their own experience. It challenges the bigotry, the stereotypes, the caricatures that fuel these hate groups. You know, you might say, it sounds like my bubba, my baby, my aunt, my uncle, and I'm not saying you'll agree with them. How often do you agree with your family members? But you begin to understand where they're coming from. That understanding is the beginning of peace. I think the media can be the greatest force for peace on earth. Instead, all too often, it's wielded as a weapon of war, which is why we have to take it back. Now, I just told you a story about history, like from 46 years ago, when KPFT was blown up by the Ku Klux Klan. I can't believe we are talking about the Ku Klux Klan today in the 2016 presidential election. How is it possible that the presumptive nominee of a major political party in this country, Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, when asked on CNN by Jake Tapper if he would disavow the support of an avowed Klan leader, right, David Duke, I can't remember if he was the Grand Dragon or the Exalted Cyclops, whether he would disavow his support and the support of the Klan, Donald Trump said he would have to look more deeply into this, consider this. When was the last time you heard Donald Trump say he needed to consider anything before he spoke? And what was it that he had to weigh more carefully? Which Klan chapter it was, because he wouldn't want to generalize to all the Klan chapters in the United States? It's extremely serious. And that's also why we need independent media. I know young people here, you've heard of the Ku Klux Klan, but do you understand exactly what it did? You know, Democracy Now!, we come from New York. We were the closest national broadcast to Ground Zero, September 11th, 2001. That horrific moment when 3,000 people were incinerated in an instant. We'll actually never know how many people died on that day, because those who go uncounted in life go uncounted in death. And they were the undocumented workers and immigrants who might have been there at that time. But what a horror that day was. However, it was not the first time that terror came to U.S. soil. Ask any African American about slavery. Ask any Native American about what's happened in this country. The Ku Klux Klan is a homegrown American terroristic organization. It was responsible for the deaths of how many thousands of people, particularly targeting African Americans, lynchings, killings, maimings. We cannot minimize the horror. I wanted to go back to last year. I wanted to go back to last June, to a moment in history that you all are familiar with, the middle of June 2015 in Charleston, South Carolina. That was the moment that a young man, a young white supremacist, walked into a Bible study group of nine, actually a few more than that, parishioners and their beloved pastor, Clemente Pinckney. He was a state senator in South Carolina. He'd raced home 2 hours just because he wanted to be at this Bible study with his parishioners midweek in the evening. And this young white man came in, and they welcomed him as they welcomed each other. And at the end of Bible study, he blew them away. He didn't kill everyone. He told a woman he wanted her to survive so she would bear witness and tell the rest of the world what he had done. A few days later, Dylan Storm Roof was arraigned, and the loved ones of the victims and the survivors put this country to shame when they forgave him. I think Dylan Roof unwittingly blew the roof off of the Confederacy. Now, a few days later, Clemente Pinckney would be one of the few African Americans to lay in state in the South Carolina Capitol Rotunda. Thousands streamed by to pay their respects. But first they had to pass on the outside, on the Capitol grounds. They had to pass by the Confederate flag flying high on those grounds that that young man had wrapped himself in. You see, the Confederate flag has flown over the capital of South Carolina since the early 60s, atop the capital. But then in 2000, the NAACP and even some sports franchises said they would boycott South Carolina if they didn't take it down. And the compromise was it would stand on the grounds of the capital, but you could never unhook it. It could never fly at half mast. And anyone who tried to deface it or take it down would face increased penalties. We raced to South Carolina. We broadcast in front of the Mother Emanuel Church. We went to the College of Charleston arena, thousands packed into the arena. That's when President Obama sang Amazing Grace. And then the next day, the beginning of the funerals, one by one. But we heard that next morning that something highly unusual had taken place in Colombia at the state capitol. Now, I think if most people are asked in this country who took down the Confederate flag off of the grounds after more than half a century, I think most people would say probably South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, that she sort of led the charge. The legislature had to debate this for a while, but that ultimately they concluded this was probably the best thing. But it wasn't Nikki Haley who first took down that flag. It was 5:30 in the morning on June 27, 2015, 10 days after the massacre at the Emanuel AME Church. The South Carolina State House glowed in the morning light. Bree Newsom, a 30-year-old African-American woman from Charlotte, North Carolina, walked toward the main entrance of the building. She was accompanied by Jimmy Tyson, a young white man from North Carolina, and others who scouted the grounds. They observed the scene around the State House, waiting until there were no guards visible. After about 30 minutes, Tyson and Newsom made their move. They walked swiftly toward the Confederate monument, which stands directly in front of the main steps. The tall monument, topped with a heroic image of a Confederate soldier, pays tribute to those who have glorified a fallen cause: slavery. The two activists proceeded to the 30-foot-high flagpole that stood directly behind the monument. The Confederate battle flag flapped lazily at the top. You know that all the flags of South Carolina flew at half-mast after the beautiful nine were massacred, except this one that waved proudly at full mast. Bree Newsom then donned her climbing gear. She'd learned how to use it a few days before. Guards moved quickly, noticing that she was ascending the flagpole swiftly, and they began shouting at her to come down. Reaching the top of the flagpole, she grabbed the Confederate flag and unhooked it. She declared, "You come against me with hatred and oppression and violence. I come against you in the name of God." She clutched the symbol of the Confederacy and said, "This flag comes down today." Bree lowered herself slowly along with the flag. As soon as she reached the ground, Newsom and Tyson were arrested. Video of the protest went viral, was seen around the world. Her bail fund quickly raised more than $125,000. Ava DuVernay, director of the Oscar-nominated film Selma, which you should all see, she was among the many to hail her, tweeting, "I hope I get the call to direct the motion picture about a black superhero I admire. Her name is Bree Newsom." But within about an hour, two State House workers raised a new Confederate flag on the Capitol grounds. And that is astounding, to actually deliberately raise that flag the day after the mass funeral, to raise that flag that same day that the bodies of the victims were being lowered into the ground in Charleston. But that's what they did. So we raced from Charleston to Columbia and went to the jailhouse where we thought Bree and Jimmy were taken. And we actually managed to get into the arraignment room and watch them charged and arraigned. Yes, Bree and Jimmy were charged with defacing state property, facing a penalty of up to 3 years in prison and a $5,000 fine. We then went to the lobby of the prison where people were gathering, hoping that Bree and Jimmy would be released that day. And I was interviewing people. I interviewed Tamika Lewis. She was a young woman who had come with Bree from North Carolina, traveling to Columbia to be part of this action. She said, "To see that flag actually come down and all the things that it represents being taken down by a strong black woman was one of the greatest symbolic images one person could ever witness." Another young woman named Carol Parker, she didn't know Bree. She grew up in Columbia, South Carolina. She walked past that flag every day, humiliated, denigrated. And she said she just was so inspired, she came to show Bree her support. Carol Parker said, "She's done what our governor hasn't had the courage to do, what our General Assembly hasn't had the courage to do. She went up there and did what had to be done when it needed to be done." Yes, it was Bree Newsom who took down the symbol of the Confederacy in South Carolina. Which brings me to a very short last three stories about history and movements that matter. I want to go back to Rosa Parks, and I always talk about Rosa Parks because even though everyone here, I'm sure, has heard her story, and the history books do tell her story, and even the media, when Rosa Parks died a few years ago, of course they took notice, they paid attention, and they told us what Rosa Parks did, but even there, they got it wrong. I remember we were in the newsroom in New York, and CNN said Rosa Parks was a tired seamstress. She was no troublemaker. Rosa Parks was a first-class troublemaker. She knew exactly what she was doing when she sat down on the bus December 1st, 1955, and refused to get up for a white passenger. A few days later, December 5th, she goes to court, and the Montgomery Improvement Association has its meeting to choose a leader to lead the bus boycott that would integrate the transportation system in Montgomery, Alabama. And they choose as their leader a young minister who just come into town, Dr. Martin Luther King. Rosa Parks helped to launch Dr. Martin Luther King. Rosa Parks was the secretary of the local NAACP. She worked with E.D. Nixon. He was the president. He came out of radical labor politics. He worked with A. Philip Randolph, the greatest organizer of the 20th century. A. Philip Randolph organized the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, the thousands of black conductors on the trains who were all called George, not because their mothers named them George, but it was named for the owner of the trains, George Pullman, which showed you why they needed to organize. And then A. Philip Randolph would go on with Bayard Rustin, the black gay pacifist activist to organize the 1963 March on Washington, where Dr. King gave his I Have a Dream speech. This is the tradition that Rosa Parks came out of. She had sat down on the bus before. And other young women had refused to get up like Rosa before. You never know when that magic moment will come. But when you're involved with social change, you help to build a foundation that will determine the future, that will make history. And to show how brave Rosa was, just go back a few months to the summer of 1955, the summer of Emmett Till, 14-year-old African-American boy in Chicago. The only child of Mamie Till. And she wanted him out of the city for the summer, so she sent him to Money, Mississippi to be with his aunt and uncle and cousins. He was asleep one night at his aunt and uncle's house when he was ripped out of bed by a white mob. They said he had wolf whistled at a white woman. Wolf whistled. Emmett had a stutter, and his mother, Mamie, taught him, every time you feel the stutter coming on, whistle. Emmett ended up in the bottom of the Tallahatchie River. When his body was dredged up and sent back to Chicago, his mother, Mamie Till, did something incredibly courageous. She said she wanted the casket open for the wake and the funeral. She wanted the world to see the ravages of racism, the brutality of bigotry. Thousands streamed by his casket and saw, and then Jet Magazine and other black publications actually took photographs of his distended, mutilated head, and they were seared into the history and consciousness of this country because they were published. Mamie Till had something very important to teach the press of today. Show the pictures. Show the images. Could you imagine if for just one week we saw the images of war? If above the fold of every surviving newspaper you saw a photograph of a baby dead on the ground, perhaps in Afghanistan, and you heard her story, you came to learn her name in an article next to it. A name is what dignifies a life, and you heard what her parents' aspirations were for their child. If the top of every radio and TV newscast for just one week told us about the casualties of war, like a woman blown up in a drone strike in Yemen who was attending a wedding party, and you learned about the young couple who'd fallen in love and what had happened, why they were eviscerated in this attack. And if everyone on their Facebook wall, every tweet, every email, for 1 week, referred to a soldier dead or dying, for just 1 week, Americans are a compassionate people. They would say, no, war is not the answer to conflict in the 21st century. I just want to end back where I began in World War II, but this in Nazi Germany, to a brother and sister named Hans and Sophie Scholl, who together with their professor and other students and workers formed the White Rose Collective. They weren't Jewish, they were German Christians, and they thought, what can we do in the face of the Nazi atrocity? They decided the best they could do was to put out a series of pamphlets to let the Germans know what was happening so they would never be able to say we didn't know. Across one of those pamphlets were written the words, "We will not be silent." They got these pamphlets distributed everywhere under cover of night, dropped in alleyways and courtyards and schoolyards and marketplaces. But then Hans and Sophie and their professor were captured. They were charged, they were tried, they were convicted, and they were beheaded. But that philosophy, that motto, should be the Hippocratic Oath of the media today, should be the Hippocratic Oath of us all today. We will not be silent. Democracy Now!
Amy Goodman, concluding her talk of May 10, 2016. Thanks again to Stan Robinson of Truth and Justice Radio for the original recording, which I have edited and condensed. Listening to Amy's talk this week and last, I was constantly reminded of David Rovics. Rovics sang about many of the same incidents that Goodman mentions here. Last week, Goodman spoke of the young Tunisian Mohamed Bouazizi. Bouazizi's public self-immolation touched off massive anti-government demonstrations. That led to the abdication of Tunisia's dictator, and it inspired the Egyptian people to do the same thing. Rovics has a very nice song on this story, titled Tunisia 2011. Then this week, Amy told the story of white racist Delan Roof and the murders he committed in Emmanuel A.M.E. Church in Charleston. All the while, not far away, the Confederate battle flag flew on the South Carolina State House lawn. 2 weeks ago, we played Rovics's new song on the same subject. It was called State House Lawn. Today, Amy added some new details to the story. New to me, anyway. Bree Newsom, a young black woman, the outraged citizen who climbed the flagpole and cut that Confederate flag down. Let's remember the names of some everyday people who rebelled and made a difference. Bree Newsom, Mohamed Bouazizi. A few years ago, David Rovics introduced me to the story of Mohamed Bouazizi. Now, thanks to Amy Goodman for introducing me to the story of Bree Newsom. One more Amy Goodman echo of David Rovics. Near the end of today's installment, Amy asks, what if the media, for once, showed the human suffering that the U.S.'s eternal wars are causing? Then what would the American people do? Come on, Amy, you're practically quoting David Rovics's well-known song, What If You Knew? You might at least mention the songwriter's name. To make amends, let's end with a Rovics song. Actually, none of the ones I mentioned, but rather, Everything Can Change. Like Amy's talk, it's a song about ordinary people sometimes changing a corrupt system. First, I'll say goodbye and thank you for listening to New World Notes. Find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. It'll get to my non-carborundum. Please come back again next week. And remember, when you're really angry, take a deep breath and count.
1, 2, 3, 4. First you have to have a problem. That part isn't hard. The second step is everybody realizing they're like you. They're holding the same card. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do and everything can change. So quick. The congressmen and businessmen and TV sets will try hard to make sure it isn't so. You don't have a problem. If you do, it's not the same problem. And if it is, well, there's just nowhere you can go. But that many times, the history is rich, though we easily forget how a meme can take hold and grab you, how it can spread out like a net, and everything can change. So quick. They'll say we are lost or we're dreaming, or they'll make a dream for us. They'll try to come up with a good story about why we belong at the back of the bus, about why we belong in this position, about how we don't know what we meant, about how there most certainly isn't any such thing as the 99%, but everything can change. So quick. Everything can change. So quick.